Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Good morning, Vachon, and thank you again, Brian Brown, for your vocal introduction to our continuing legacy of progressive radio and progressive persuasion that we've now refined to a fine art. And thank you, Truman, for a morning scramble. Great last song to get us all rolling for the Brown Briefly today. That was awesome. This morning, dear listeners, we have Truman O'Brien in the Gene Bosch studio. We have Lynn Kerrigan right next to Truman in the Gene Bosch studio. I think they're about 6 feet apart.
Oh, yeah, 6 feet. Exactly. Six feet.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay, guys. I see the tape on the floor now.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, we got it measured up.
And Gail Kellner is with us today. Hi, Gail.
Good morning.
And Bruce Hallman, of course, our guardian of the galaxy.
Good to be here.
Likewise. Hey, my name is Kevin Jones, as you probably have surmised. And I will just mention that tonight at 9 o'clock, the Progressive Vachon podcast is going to feature Shasti Conrad. She's the chair of the King County Democrats, and our own Senator Joe Wynn, and Toshiko Hasegawa, the executive director of the Washington State Commission on Asia Pacific American Affairs. And they're going to be talking with Stephen Cox today about what can be done about Asian American hate. That's tonight at 9 o'clock right here on Voice of Vachon, if you have the time to tune in. All right. So, hey, Brieflys, we had a graduation on Vachon last week, and I had the pleasure of driving through town and seeing the festivities around the parade. I'm not sure who was able to take that in. Any feedback from Brieflys on the graduation? Bruce.
Yeah, I watched part of it, not all of it, but watched part of it. And I was struck by two things. And if you looked in the Beachcomber this past week, they had the photographs of the graduating seniors. And two sort of things struck me. And I was with my friend Alice Larson outside of her shop, sort of watching the part of the parade. And one of the things we noticed is I think there were 6 or 7 Latino graduates from high school this year, mm-hmm. all male. Yes. But that's a significant kind of accomplishment on Vachon. And the other thing, when you look through the photos of the graduates, two things struck me there. One, the number of people of color, Latinos, Asian Americans, African Americans. I mean, it's growing on Vachon. And also part of that is the number of students who are from off island who are graduating from Vachon High School. It's become a significant percentage. You know, there's 350 odd students coming from off island, which is keeping our student population even at about 1,400, 1,500. But also the fact that 20% of the school population is people of color on Vachon. And only 2% of the faculty is people of color. So interesting work that the school district has before it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Any other thoughts or comments on either the parade or the graduation or school in general on Truman?
Well, I just need to throw out a huge thank you to the good old Voice of Vachon, our host here tonight or today, because they did a great job of emceeing the parade. Kevin Joyce and Jeff Hoyt were up on the stage, and I thought they did a wonderful job. I did not get to see it, unfortunately. I had a work party that I was running that day, so I was unable to be here. But I thought it was pretty amazing that they did that.
Gail.
Oh, I'd just like to add in that for those of us who have sat through more than one graduation on the benches in the of Vachon, this is a welcome change in many a community, on many of hind end across the state and maybe around the country. I didn't happen to see Vashon's, but I was in Port Townsend and saw their parade. And it was just so festive and fun. And because it was big and outdoor and spacious, they did a similar sort of car parade. It just felt like the whole community was a part of it. And it didn't involve the hours of sitting, waiting for one graduate at a time to walk across a stage, which is a little anticlimactic for 12 years of education. Maybe they're just paying us back for all the sitting we made them do.
Good point. You know, I think it was Voice of Vashon where I heard about the graduation parade. It might have been the Beachcomber, but I'm pretty sure Voice of Vashon. Yeah. So
this was our second year of doing it. I think it's going to become a tradition now on the island. People love it so much. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Fantastic. Lynn, I see you have a comment.
I just want to add my congratulations. I didn't see the parade. I saw Bainbridge Island's graduation in their environment, not the actual graduation, but they had a tradition there of marking on the sidewalks and the streets chalk messages from the grads to announce where they lived, you know, small island. And I thought that was a kind of a great tradition. But I just want to thank all of the teachers here and the students for their hard work. I was really impressed when I was teaching at the UW to notice that Vashon High School had one of the highest reputations in the whole state. I think it came in at number one at having its student population succeed in college. They had the highest rates of graduation and the highest, finishing their careers of all the places in the state. So I just want to say good job, everybody, and welcome to the adult world. Ha ha.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got to be tough to live on Vashon. So I guess it's showing there. Yeah. Gail.
Oh, just one last thought that I think especially a big shout out to all the teachers across the island for their perseverance through the pandemic and having to completely revamp curriculums and ways of delivering curriculum to students during this time. And they did it. And I think we owe a great deal of gratitude to them. And I think it also became very apparent to parents just the work that teachers do, especially in the grades where you're really monitoring behavior. You know, it's about 50-50 teaching and managing children. And, you know, that I think that having that burden put back on parents 24/7 helped them really come around to the appreciating what teachers really do every day. And not only with, you know, two or three or five children, but, you know, 15, 20, 30, 35 children at a time. So it's, in some ways, I think it's highlighted the great work of the educators in our community.
Well, I'll certainly amplify that. I spent a little time with the Green Team a couple of years ago, and we started out at the beginning of the school year where they were at McMurray, and they were bringing all the classes together to introduce themselves to each other basically at the start of the school year. And the thought that went into that, the creating relationships between the different grades, the teachers' vigilance and awareness of how all the students were interacting with each other and supporting mm-hmm. them and helping them with that whole socialization process was very eye-opening to me. Mm-hmm. That's spectacular what's done there. I will also say it is a big, huge event. You know, my just a couple of doors down, there's a Vashon High School graduate from last year, and they had the signs that they were putting out in the yards, because of COVID, you know, is starting to become an issue. And that sign is still there. I can proudly say just a couple doors down from a Vashon High grad.
What does the sign say, Kevin?
Congratulations, Vashon High School graduate 2020, yeah. I believe.
Okay, got you.
Yeah. So let's see, also on Vashon, you know, signs of things are changing. The night light drive-in movies are starting up again on May 28th through the 30th. That's open space in the Vashon Theater for socially distanced movies. And I saw that. I thought that was fantastic. You know, this is sort of year two of that activity. But meanwhile, I also encountered a little mask-wearing resistance last week on Vashon. And the resistance was like, why was I still wearing one? So, you know, we're starting to see this shift now. I'm just curious what the Briefleys think or what you've experienced regarding masks. You know, should we, shouldn't we? When's the time to change? Truman, what are your thoughts?
I was over at Katie Downs, the restaurant on Ruston yesterday for lunch. I met some friends over there for lunch. And the sign on the door said, those of you who aren't vaccinated, we recommend that you wear your mask. That was all it said. So, and I was surprised. There were still a number of people wearing masks, but many people were not at that point. And I looked around at the ones who were not, and they were all of a particular vintage, which I represent, if you know what I mean.
Maybe we represent?
Yeah, I think so. Exactly.
Okay, Lynn, your thoughts?
I noticed for myself, because I'm vaccinated, that I am now starting to forget to put my mask on where I should have it on. I walked into Doug's and was talking to Diana about getting an appointment for our car, and I realized I had pulled my mask down to say hello to her and show her who I was and forgot to put it back on, and she had to remonstrate me to put my mask back on. I was so ashamed because I had been faithfully wearing it in every possible venue. And then I just noticed I'm starting to forget. So sorry, Diana.
That's a good thing, I think, that you're starting to forget.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, Gail, what do you think?
Oh, just I was going to comment that our restaurant, Ruby Brink, there on the our one and only four-way stop on the island, they no longer require masks, so it's not required either for the servers or the employees there, but nor the people that come in.
Wow,
good. And I think they're going to open indoor dining, I think, pretty soon too, aren't they?
And they've just completed their patio.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, the outdoor patio is beautiful and wonderful place to sit. And they are opening for indoor dining soon. It's been a little bit of a rolling date, but I think
it's within the next week or so.
Yeah. Well,
yeah. I mean, it's interesting. Next week, all the mandates come down. Washington State will be totally open. So it's going to be really interesting, I think, to see how we respond as a society and as individuals to the fact that the mask is there not so much to protect you as to protect others. And, you know, there's a social responsibility when you're in crowded spaces to be aware of transmitting a disease. It's like before COVID, did you walk into a store when you were hacking and sneezing with the flu, or were you cautious about that? And we've become a bit inured to that sort of social responsibility of how we transmit illnesses because of the pandemic and because of masks. But I think it's going to be very interesting. And myself, I'm going to wear a mask in crowded spaces. I'm going to be cautious, not for myself. I'm vaccinated, but you don't know who's not, and you don't know who you can transmit a disease to, because even though you're vaccinated, you can still transmit the disease, as I understand it. So.
Well, it also seems, you know, what we heard, that the flu incidents were down as well. Of course, people are staying home and people are taking those additional precautions. But, you know, it seems like the payoff of taking those precautions is a pretty small price to pay for not being sick for a week with the flu or something like that, or the common cold. So for me, it's a reasonable trade-off. Given, you know, the outdoor movies thing and the fact that we're in this transition period and hopefully, you know, cross our fingers, better things to come yet. The folks who I talked to said we're 90% vaccinated now on Vashon and nearing, if not at, 75%, I think, for the county. So what do you think? Are the socially distanced movies going to be a thing? Is that going to attract people, or is it like, no, we're going to go back to the old way of watching movies? Any thoughts on that?
I love the idea of a drive-in. I think that's creative and it's nostalgic for me. You know, we had drive-ins a lot as kids. That's how families afforded to take their kids out to a movie. And, you know, there were playgrounds there. And I loved going to drive-ins. I'm going to have to find somebody to go with me, though, because it seems kind of sad to go at $20 a car for one person. So I encourage carpooling, and I'm looking forward to it. I also like to sit anonymously in an indoor theater, and have already done that when they opened for Nomadland at Art Vachon Theater. So maybe can my answer be both?
Yeah, particularly if Johnny Depp is there, right?
Johnny Depp, that's right. He's a little flat with his affect, you know, the little cardboard cutout of my date, Johnny Depp, for those of you who don't know what he was referring right. to. You know, but a flat affect is nothing for those looks, you know.
Yeah, we need those repeat listeners to recall back to your discussion about sitting twice with Johnny Depp, I think, in the Vachon Theater, although
right.
he was, like you say, fairly plasticized. Gail, you had a comment.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, I think that movies are really the modern, it's really the art form will be, our times will be remembered for. It's, you know, I don't think that it will be the art on walls as much as I love it. I think it will be the movies. They combine storytelling with the visual effects, with music. It just has it all. And so there's just nothing quite like seeing that on a big screen with a group of people. So I do hope that we go back, at least there are certain, particularly where the cinematography is outstanding. You want to see that on a big screen if you have a chance. So.
Mm-hmm. And Gail, your background is different today. Are you on a different island? Do I recall it correctly?
Good noticing. Well, I've mm-hmm. moved into the attic of my house, as it turns out. See the little those of you on the radio can't, but there's little slivers in my fingernails from trying to hold on to my house. The ways I've done it is by house sharing. So I've moved up into the attic, and I'm cozy in about 650 square feet of, you know, but it's great. I absolutely have no complaints. It's quite lovely up here.
All right. Well, I knew you were going to be doing some island hopping.
Island hopping, but I actually, for now, am on Vachon. So
okay.
I'll be here for a while.
Okay. So, hey, let's move a little bit to national news. And Juneteenth is now an official national holiday. Bruce, I'm just wondering if this is a prelude maybe to additional racial equity moves from the Biden administration. What are your thoughts?
Well, yeah, I think, Biden's got 2 years, well, now a year and a half to really implement his sort of agenda, if you will. And my sense is there's a number of social justice moves that came out of both the pandemic and the Black Lives Matter movement that I think we're going to see them implemented nationally, at least by federal policy. And so, yeah, I think I don't think it's a particularly well-organized response by the Biden administration. It's kind of piecemeal. But my sense is, yeah, this is the first of one of many. And of course, we'll talk about it later, but the For the People Act is the really big piece of that social justice agenda, as well as the border wall. And so you've got, a number of things working right now with the Biden administration. And whether they'll be able to pull it off is sort of the question. And we'll know after the initial vote today on the For the People Act.
You're right. We will plan to get to that. But before we do, I'm just curious what the Briefleys think about this recognition of Juneteenth. You know, it's 150 years after Union troops arrived in Galveston Bay, Texas, to announce that the more than 250,000 enslaved Black people in the state were free by executive decree. And this is some time after the Emancipation Proclamation had been signed in. So is it too late? Is it better late than never? Truman, looks like you have a thought. Or Lynn.
Hey, go ahead, Lynn.
I was just going to say that out of my deep cynicism, I think, I am glad for any kind of recognition that the Black community is getting about their history. I think that's important and necessary. But I also feel like it's a little bit of an empty, low-hanging fruit kind of accomplishment, wherein for me, I'd rather see additionally some of the issues that the Black community has been highlighting, being voted on, things like gun safety and policing that is less biased and better education, you know, less discrimination in very specific areas. So at my best, I can take Juneteenth as a flag, you know, that's being waved very easily by both parties at this point. But I don't want it to be a smokescreen for other issues that need action.
What I was going to say is I grew up until I was 11 years old down in West Texas. And in those days, even in West Texas, it was still segregated. I mean, I remember black-only bathrooms and black water fountains, you know, that were separated. And I remember Juneteenth. The folks always were saying, oh, you know, that, I mean, it was always a kind of a happy celebration. And we had a woman who was a black woman who took care of my two older brothers when they were little and did some house cleaning and all of that. But she was like part of the family. And she used to call my mom Mrs. O'Brown, which I always thought was really funny when I was a little kid. But her name was Jessamay Black. I remember very distinctly. And I remember Juneteenth. That was a big deal for there for her whole community. Mm-hmm. And my folks always got a kind of laugh out of it because they had such a good time. It was such a party time for them. So anyway, thought that was interesting.
You know, it's just so intriguing to me that because of more work that I have the opportunity to do in support of groups like Black Pack. Adrienne Shropshire is the founder of Black Pack. She grew up in Seattle. She was visiting in Seattle during Juneteenth to visit with her family to celebrate. And it just seems that there's this whole culture that has been off our radar, off the white culture's radar screen in this country, right? Some, of course, Truman, is your experience is that you've interacted with folks who celebrated Juneteenth. Mm-hmm. I had not. and so there's just, I guess, fascination on my part. You know, we celebrate cultures in different ways. The different groups bring such a richness, right, into our communities. And some of those are just overlooked. So hopefully to be discovered and cherished as we go forward.
Yeah, I think, let me take a little bit of issue with Lynn. I mean, I don't think it's low-hanging fruit in the sense that you mean it, Lynn. It's relatively easy to get it through right now because there's a consensus. And that's critically important at this point in Americans' political sort of state, to find something that has universal support. I mean, there were only, 21 or so Republicans that voted against it. I think that's highly significant. And it's important not to denigrate, you know, the idea of things that have been part of a minority community for 150 years and have been a major celebration within the Black community. And to recognize that and to elevate that to a national holiday, I think is symbolically very, very important. And particularly as we move forward in the next couple of years and in the next decade, as we begin to address all of the issues that were raised by the Black Lives Matter movement and now the anti-Asian violence movement, I think it's critically important that we have these sort of milestones that represent the consensus in a deeply divided country. So I don't see it as low-hanging fruit. I see it as a major victory for a consensus about racial politics in the United States. Not that it's going to move smoothly, but that it's the first step in a sea change that's coming in terms of racial politics in the United States.
I hope you're right, Bruce. That's important to have said, and I certainly didn't mean in any way to denigrate the celebration, just to put it in context of other action items that I hope will follow.
Gail had a comment, and then Truman.
Yeah, I think it's, Lynn, I appreciate what you're saying, because I think sometimes we can say, well, we've got it now. You know, we've done this thing and therefore we've done enough. And yet I also see what you're saying, Bruce, and agree that it's the first rung or maybe a few rungs up on the ladder towards towards moving towards more racial equity and recognition. But it reminds me a little bit of the Me Too, the hashtag Me Too movement. It's like, yes, we should stop assaulting women. let's start there. But it died. It petered after that. Right now, we're just sitting there. We've done nothing about structural structural inequalities with regard to gender issues when it comes to women. Women have continued to suffer through this pandemic in job loss and the weight of care for families. We continue to be underpaid. And it's baked right into the system with regard to something like Social Security, you know, so that when a woman goes to collect Social Security, well, she may have giant gaps in her earning years because she was raising children, and that's not recognized at all as in any kind of way to valid or important. So I think that that's the piece that I'm kind of like, it's not enough. It's not enough just to recognize a national holiday. I mean, we do have to just keep climbing that ladder. And I'm waiting for the next serious feminist movement around issues for women. I see all these other social issues coming to fruition, coming to like the social consciousness, but somehow, wow, it's okay to essentially enslave women in terms of the way that we use and abuse them. And even though maybe now we no longer actually reach out and people get called out for the physical abuse.
I just wanted to throw out one thing to
support. Sorry for that rant.
It's
sorry,
okay. Go ahead, Truman. I just wanted to throw one thing out to support what Lynn said when she said low hanging fruit. I think she was right. I think that that this was an item that, and to support what you're saying, Bruce, this was an item that made it easy for people to come together, and I think it made it easy for our politicians to say, yeah, we can both get together and work on that. And I think you're right, Bruce. That might be a first step in getting some of this nonpartisanship to come together. But I think she's right in terms of saying low hanging fruit. That was an easy one for them to come together on. And I think it's important.
Yeah, I don't think it's an either or argument. I think that there's many facets to the symbology and the conscious and unconscious actions, you know, we make about really controversial issues. And Gail, you know, your description of the similarities to some of the issues with women and equal rights versus sort of talking about equal rights, you know, they're two different things. And I celebrate anything that is helpful to the African-American cause here. It's just I stand with them in their belief that it's enough. They have had enough of our discrimination, and I'm proud of them for speaking out so much and for celebrating this holiday of emancipation. That I think is critically important, as you say, Bruce, and that whites listen to that and the people in power. I just watched these voting rights bills, you know, be highlighted, which is what I'm sort of frantically hoping we can repair a little bit. And it just seems like we're at a standoff with that, as we are about gun safety, and hoping that we can use some of these more symbolic, deeper wishes and celebrations of our cultures to pull together a little bit to make democracy mean something to everybody.
There's this challenge of I think that there's so many aspects right to this discussion and this particular point, and I think we is on Progressive Persuasion Radio hope that, you know, some of these events are going to break the dam, right, and we see progressive change flowing like a river. But, you know, there's also the reality of one step forward, two steps back that we have to contend with in this challenging environment we're in. Gail, to your point on the headline, Republican filibuster blocks pay equity bill in the Senate. which was an article in the New York Times on June 8th of this year. So yes, still challenges to face. You know, so another bellwether that's approaching this week is the sentencing of Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd. And I'm curious what people think about what we might expect in terms of the national reaction to that sentencing. And how is what's our expectation, and how is our expectation different than maybe what we'd like to see? Any thoughts?
I just want to throw out one thing. Bruce is always asking me, you know, what are your Army buddies thinking? You know, some of these things that are going on, and the one thing that I've seen from them is them complaining about the martyrdom of George Floyd. I mean, it's obviously that what Chauvin did was absolutely unacceptable, and but they're saying we should be naming plazas after this guy who had 8 convictions, you know, 8 criminal, spent time in prison, and, you know, for aggravated home invasion. And I mean, we're making a, you know, a hero out of this guy. And I agree with that. I mean, I think what Chauvin did was absolutely despicable. That was not acceptable. But I don't think we need to elevate a criminal, you know, to a position of you know, I don't know, whatever. But that's one of the things my buddies are saying.
All right. Yeah. Gail, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I appreciate that, Truman. And I think it's a perspective on that might be that he's not really being elevated as an individual, but as an individual who represents the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Black men in particular, but Black folk in general that have been killed by police officers unjustly. So he's really just a figurehead in some, right, at some level. It's not so much about him in particular.
No, as I understand that completely. I'm just saying that that's what these.
Yeah, are. And I'm with you on that. I get that.
Well, then also, if I can jump in, let's remember the Black Lives Movement was a moment in time, and that moment is passing. And so what we have really, and what I think we'll see in reaction to Chauvin's, you know, sentencing, is a recognition that the justice system can work, which in many instances it doesn't work, and then a concerted push to make sure it works more equitably across the spectrum, because the Black Lives Movement was really, I mean, it arose about how George Floyd was treated and was killed, murdered, basically. But it has become more than that, as Gail and Truman both pointed out. And so what I see is emerging is really that moment of Black Lives Matter is passing. The moment of anti-Asian violence is passing as the figurehead. And what's going to emerge, I think, is this sense that we really need to rethink the social justice system in the United States. We need to rethink how policing takes place in the United States. And so let's not forget, and I think the recognition of George Floyd is so that we don't forget that moment in time, because there's going to be several more, and maybe dozens more of those moments before we get to a truly equitable sort of criminal justice system in the United States. But these are critical steps to getting there.
Yeah.
Our listeners can't see the thumbs up in response to Bruce's comments here. But Lynn, you wanted to add some.
Well said. I think you're talking about the, you know, the long game and the structural changes that can follow these watershed moments. And I know for me, I was very heartened by the fact that Derek Chauvin was charged with murder. I think that was a huge watershed moment, that the bad actions of a rogue cop is called out for what it is. It's not so much policing as, you know, he made an egregious error that came to symbolize all the murders of Blacks over the last 400 years. And I was, I don't want to say I was happy that he was, you know, found guilty of murder, but what I'm saying is as a symbolic moment, that's one that meant something to me because I felt like that was a huge change, and it has led to a relook at all of our policing. And why is it that, you know, cops have been so militarized, and why is it, you know, that it's an us and them kind of approach from policing, you know, to getting to choose what communities, you know, they can keep safe. So I think that there's huge questions, as you said, that is emerging from all of this. And I'm grateful for that.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's a, you know, a many step process, but in some ways a two step in that he was charged. He was found guilty, or a three step charged, found guilty. This sentencing is as important to moving towards justice and a very as equal in weight as those other two moments. And it would be unfortunate if the sentence did not represent the weight of the actions and the movement. It would unfortunately undo a lot of the progress we've done. If it's like, well, you know, you're off in the with a minor slap on the hand of some kind.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, speaking of progress to be made, today could be will be a watershed day, I think, regardless of how the vote in the Senate turns out regarding the For the People Act. It's curious, you know, so what are the possibilities, right? Will McConnell successfully rally the Republicans to unite in opposition of the For the People Act? And how many, you know, there's several Republicans working on a compromise bill. I believe there's at least five, but maybe as many as 10. And just curious where they might come down on the bill in terms of the vote that's scheduled today. And briefly, what do you think about all that? And like, what do you really see as the most important part of the For the People Act from your perspective?
Well, if I can jump in, I think the Republicans today are going to find it very difficult to vote against this procedural act to talk about it. I mean, that's all that's being voted on today. And I know McConnell's trying to sort of rally the troops, but the reality is today is a procedural vote. And for the Republicans, for particularly those moderate Republicans and those Republicans who are in districts, who will be challenged, I think they're going to find it very difficult to vote not to talk about it. I mean, whether they'll vote in favor of it when it comes to a final vote, but in terms of the sort of the optics, if you will, of refusing to even talk about voting reform, I think it's just not tenable, even for the Republican Party at this point, particularly given the big lie and sort of the election was stolen. This idea of voter reform should be at the top of their agenda. And so they're caught in a difficult place. So today, I don't, you know, again, hard to know. We'll know in a couple hours, I think. But my sense is it won't be an absolute Republican opposition to talking about it, you know. When it comes to the floor for a final vote, that's up for grabs.
And thank you for clarifying that, Bruce. I think that is important for our listeners to know.
Okay.
that it is a procedural vote today. Yeah, Lynn.
I heard on NPR this morning, it was interesting, having been raised in the South, where, you know, the arguments about the Civil War being about slavery versus states' rights remains an argument. And I heard on NPR them saying the same thing, that the opposition seems to think that this is a states' rights point of view, that elections have always been in the states. We don't need any federal oversight of it. And more importantly, they said our election held up this last go-round because there was not federal consolidation or centralization of the vote. And I thought that was kind of an ingenious shift of topic to saying that because our system worked and it created a win, they did not acknowledge the big lie, number one, you know, that the former president still claims to have won, and that many Republicans still follow that. But I thought that I thought it was disingenuous to kind of turn it to a states' rights issue and basically stand for the idea that states have the right to do anything they want in their electoral processes, even if there's egregious sort of opposition to getting people to vote by mail or early or whatever makes it easier to vote. So it, for me, feels like a lot of confusion, a lot of noise about side issues that have been used for 200 years, you know, to justify cracking down on the votes in the South in particular.
Yeah, Gail, your thoughts?
I was just, you know, reading through the bill or proposed bill. I was just absolutely so thrilled at its the breadth of it. You know, the scope of it is amazing. You know, everything from informing young voters to creating, you know, a holiday on the day that, you know, on the day that of national elections. The protections for, you know, around the egregious effects of gerrymandering. It is just, I was absolutely so pleased to see someone write something so comprehensive. And I recognize that its complete form will probably not be passed, but the fact that we are addressing it at such big, deep levels makes me gives me a lot of hope that we will get something through that will be much improved and rein some of the states in that are just wildly out there trying to suppress the vote.
And you didn't mention the other thing that it does is requires disclosure of tax returns from presidential candidates, which is, of course, a popular progressive notion. Sort of radical, I know, totally radical, but something we've all been doing as a matter of course up until, 2016. So
reminds me a little bit about the adage of making legislation is a bit like making sausage. You don't want to watch.
Yes, for sure.
So my sense is, what's impressive to me is that I think it's 68% of the American people favor these kinds of electoral reforms. And so Republicans, they may not all pass. And I think, Gail, you're right. They're going to be compromises along the way. It's not going to be as it was written. But I think there's a good chance that what we'll see is some significant sort of voter reform come out of this legislation. And I think the Republicans are going to have a hard time resisting it, particularly looking at the 2022 election.
Well, I allow my cynicism to be public for just a moment. Nine Republicans can vote in favor without going over that line of going forward, right, into that discussion, Bruce. So I'm going to be very curious, you know, if the number comes out to 7, 8, 9, and where does it cut off? You know, I think these things are all, frankly, pretty well scripted, we'll see. The other thing, if you've heard Patty Murray, our senator, talk more about this issue, it's not by accident. We've been working really closely with her office and making lots of phone calls. And she was on KUOW this last week. She's had her article in the Spokesman Review. She can be reached at 202-224-2621. And Senator Cantwell can be reached, same phone number, last four digits, 3441. If you'd like to see the For the People Act, give them a call today. Just let them know you're there supporting them in not only voting for it, but joining the national narrative. We need to create some dominoes that start to fall to create some momentum. And your senators hearing from you, just let them know that you've got their back.
Kevin, would you repeat that number one more time?
I will. The number is 202-224-2621 for Senator Murray.